Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90 exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
Look at you go, knocking stuff out, letting nothing get in the way. Whatever life throws at you, you throw it back at 97 miles an hour. And if the chips are down, you make more guacamole. Yes, you've got what it takes. Because there's no stopping you with you on your side. Everwise believes in the power of you, cheering as you take on the world. Everwise Credit Union. Confidence changes everything. Now go get 'em.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Story one, I never believed in ghosts until I started working night shifts at Memorial Heights, a skilled nursing facility about 40 minutes outside Denver. I'm Leah, been a CNA for 6 years now, and what happened during my third month on the Alzheimer's ward still makes me question everything I thought I knew about reality. It was a particularly brutal January night. Temperatures had dropped below zero, and the ancient heating system in our facility was struggling to keep up. The halls were quiet except for the occasional moaning from room 213, where Mrs. Peterson was having one of her restless nights. "Just gonna be you and me tonight, Leah," my supervisor Donna had told me before she left for her smoke break at 2 a.m. We were short-staffed, again, and I had 17 patients to check on throughout my shift. I was making my rounds when I noticed Mr. Galloway was awake, sitting upright in his bed and staring at his door. Mr. Galloway rarely spoke coherently anymore, so I was surprised when he grabbed my wrist as I approached to check his vitals. "He's making rounds tonight," he whispered, his eyes surprisingly clear. "Who is Mr. Galloway?" I asked, checking his forehead for fever. "The doctor, the one who doesn't belong here." He pointed a shaking finger toward the hallway. "Tall man, black coat, always checking charts at night." I patted his hand. "There's no doctor on duty tonight, sir. Just me and Donna. Would you like some water before you go back to sleep?" He shook his head frantically. "Not thirsty. Just watch out for him. He's not here to help." The way he said it sent a chill down my spine, but I'd gotten used to these kinds of statements from patients with dementia. I recorded his vitals, all normal, and continued my rounds. Around 3:30 a.m., I was in the supply closet at the end of the East Wing, restocking my cart with fresh linens. The closet was tiny, barely enough room for me in the cart, with shelves of supplies lining both walls. I was reaching for some washcloths on the top shelf when I heard the door creak behind me. "Donna? That you?" I called out, but got no answer. I turned slightly, just enough to see the door was still closed. Must have been the building settling in the cold. I went back to counting washcloths. That's when I felt it. The sensation of someone standing directly behind me. Not just a feeling, but an actual presence, complete with the subtle shift in air pressure that happens when someone enters your personal space. Before I could turn around, I felt a hand on my shoulder. Not a pat or a grab, but a firm, deliberate placement of 5 fingers against my scrub top. I could feel the pressure of each individual digit, and they felt cold, even through the fabric. I froze, washcloths clutched to my chest. The pressure on my shoulder increased slightly, as if whoever, whatever, was behind me was using me for balance. I could hear breathing now, slow and measured, right next to my ear. My heart hammering, I forced myself to turn around. Nothing. The closet was empty, except for me and my cart. The door was still firmly closed. I dropped the washcloths and bolted out of that closet so fast I nearly took the door off its hinges. I ran straight to the nurse's station, where Donna was just returning from her break. "Jesus, Leah," You look like you've seen a ghost, she said, unwrapping her scarf. I told her what happened, and she brushed it off. Old buildings make weird noises, and your mind plays tricks during graveyard shifts. I tried to believe that. I really did. A week later, I was assigned to Mrs. Lowell in room 219. She was a new admission, early stage Alzheimer's, but still mostly lucid. Sweet lady, former kindergarten teacher, who loved to talk about her students. Around midnight, I went in to help her to the bathroom. As I was helping her back to bed, she grabbed my hand. Has he been in to see you yet? She asked, her voice suddenly lower. Who, Mrs. Lowell? The doctor, the one who walks the halls at night. She looked toward her door. He's been visiting my room, stands at the foot of my bed and writes things on a clipboard. My skin prickled. When does he come? Always after midnight, always alone. She settled back against her pillows. I asked the day nurse about him, but she said there's no doctor who matches that description working here. I tried to keep my voice steady. What does he look like? Mrs. Lowell's face took on an expression I can only describe as peaceful dread. Tall, thin, always in an old-fashioned black doctor's coat, his face ... She trailed off, looking past me. His face, I prompted. I can never quite see it clearly. It's like there's something wrong with the light when he's in the room. She suddenly gripped my arm with surprising strength. He was in here last night, standing right there by the door, watching me. I asked what he wanted, and do you know what he said? I shook my head, unable to speak. He said, just making my final rounds. Then he smiled. She shuddered. His teeth were all wrong. I finished my checks quickly and left her room, telling myself it was just another confused patient. But I couldn't shake the similarities with what Mr. Galloway had described. That night around 3 a.m., I was at the nurse's station updating charts when I noticed the temperature in the hallway seemed to drop suddenly. The fluorescent light above me flickered once, twice, then stabilized. I looked up from my paperwork and saw a figure at the far end of the corridor, just on the edge of where the light reached. It was tall and thin, dressed in what looked like a long, dark coat. Not modern medical scrubs or a white lab coat, but something older, more formal. The figure stood completely still, facing in my direction. I squinted, trying to make out details. Hello? I called out, my voice echoing in the empty hallway. Can I help you? The figure didn't respond. Instead, it turned slowly and walked into room 213, Mrs. Peterson's room. I jumped up and rushed down the hallway, my rubber-soled shoes squeaking against the linoleum. I reached room 213 in seconds and pushed the door open, flipping on the light. Mrs. Peterson was asleep in her bed, breathing steadily, but the room was empty otherwise. No tall doctor, no one in a black coat. And despite running the whole way there, I couldn't shake the feeling that I'd somehow missed him, that whoever I'd seen had simply vanished. 3 days later, Mrs. Peterson died in her sleep. Some things you just can't explain away, and some presences you don't want to encounter again. People tell me it was just exhaustion or my imagination being triggered by the patient's similar stories. Story 2. It was my third week on the night shift at Westbrook Memorial. The hospital was built in the 1930s, and parts of it still looked like something out of a black and white movie. I'm Tim, 28, from rural Nebraska. I took the job because the pay was better than anything else within 50 miles of my place, and nursing homes were all I'd ever known work-wise. Working overnight in the hospice ward was, well, exactly what you'd expect. Quiet, too quiet, the kind of quiet that makes every pipe knock and elevator ding feel like someone's watching you. Most nights were the same. Routine checks, medication rounds, and lots of paperwork. I got used to the rhythm, the occasional death, the calls to families at 3 a.m. What I didn't get used to was room 417. Room 417 was at the end of the East Wing corridor. Everyone hated that room, not because it was any different from the others. Same beige walls, same window view of the parking lot, same medical equipment, but something about it just felt wrong. Patients assigned there never lasted long, even ones who weren't supposed to be close to the end. That night in October, we had a new patient moved into 417. Mrs. Winters, 89, advanced dementia. She was transferred from a nursing home because her condition had deteriorated rapidly. According to her chart, she hadn't spoken or responded to stimuli in over 2 months. She just existed, breathing, blinking occasionally, but not really there. My supervisor, Darlene, asked me to handle Mrs. Winters' care for the night. "Just keep her comfortable," she said. "Family's already said their goodbyes." Around 1 a.m., I went in to check her vitals and repositioning. The room was freezing despite the thermostat reading 72 degrees. I adjusted Mrs. Winters' blankets and checked her IV line while talking softly to her, like I always did with non-responsive patients. "Looks like we might get some snow tonight, Mrs. Winters. First of the season. The parking lot lights make it look pretty when it falls." Nothing. Just the mechanical rise and fall of her chest and the steady beep of the heart monitor. Her eyes were half open but unfocused, staring at the ceiling. I continued my tasks, recording her vitals in the chart. Her blood pressure was low, but that wasn't unusual. As I was writing, I felt the air get even colder, the kind of cold that makes your lungs hurt when you breathe in. I rubbed my arms, making a mental note to ask maintenance about the heating in this room. That's when I heard it. "He's here again." The voice was so clear and sudden that I dropped my pen. Mrs. Winters hadn't moved, but her eyes were now full.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com. /boxing.
Look at you go, knocking stuff out, letting nothing get in the way. Whatever life throws at you, you throw it back at 97 miles an hour. And if the chips are down, you make more guacamole. Yes, you got what it takes. Because there's no stopping you with you on your side. Everwise believes in the power of you, cheering as you take on the world. Everwise Credit Union. Confidence changes everything. Now go get them.
Could you use some extra cash right now? You could earn up to $150 when you open a personal checking account with Centra. Centra's checking accounts are designed to fit your needs. Open your checking account online at Centra.org or stop by a Centra location today. Centra Credit Union, centered around you. Limited time offer. Full requirements, including eligible accounts and disclosures, available at Centra.org. Federally insured by NCUA. Equal housing opportunity.
Open, alert in a way they shouldn't have been. "Mrs. Winters?" I approached her bed slowly. "Did you say something?" She didn't respond. Back to the vacant stare. I must have imagined it, I thought. Sleep deprivation playing tricks on me. I picked up my pen and finished my notes. As I was hanging the chart back on the bed, Mrs. Winters' head slowly turned toward the corner of the room. There was nothing there. Just the standard chair for visitors and a small table with a lamp. "Every night," she said, her voice surprisingly strong. "Standing right there, watching." My skin erupted in goosebumps. I looked at the corner again. Empty. "Who's watching, Mrs. Winters?" I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. She didn't answer me directly, just kept staring at the corner. "He comes for everyone in this room, always has." I stepped closer to her bed. "Mrs. Winters, there's nobody there." She smiled then, a small, knowing smile that didn't belong on someone with advanced dementia. "Not for you to see, not yet." I swallowed hard. "I'm going to get you some water, okay?" Her hand shot out and grabbed my wrist with surprising strength. Her skin was ice cold. "Don't leave," she whispered. "He doesn't like to be acknowledged." I gently removed her hand. "I'll be right back, I promise." As I turned to leave, the lamp in the corner flickered once, twice. Mrs. Winters laughed, a dry, rattling sound. "He says you look like the Johnson boy, the one who died here in 58. I froze. My grandfather's brother had died as a teenager at this hospital in the late 1950s. Heart failure. I'd seen photos. People said I looked just like him. There was no way Mrs. Winters could know that. I turned back slowly. What did you say? But Mrs. Winters was back to her previous state, eyes vacant, face expressionless. I called her name several times, even gently shook her shoulder. Nothing. I practically ran from the room, telling myself I had misheard her, that the similarities were coincidental, that patients with dementia sometimes had moments of bizarre lucidity. When I returned with water 10 minutes later, Mrs. Winters was gone. Not physically, her body was still there, but she had passed away. Time of death, 1:27 a.m. During morning handover, I mentioned the strange interaction to Darlene. She looked uncomfortable. Room 417 has a history, was all she said. We try not to put patients there, but sometimes we're full and don't have a choice. Story 3. I've worked night shifts at Joanna's nursing home for almost 5 years. It's an old Victorian building that was converted in the 70s, tucked away in rural Minnesota. The pay is decent and the nights are usually quiet, which gives me time to study for my RN degree. 3 weeks ago, we got a new resident in room 217. Mrs. Abernathy, 84, terminal pancreatic cancer. She was placed on our palliative wing, expected to last maybe a month. Sweet lady, always thanking us even when we had to wake her for meds or change her bedding at 3 a.m. On her fourth night, I was doing my 2 a.m. rounds when I heard her call button. I found her sitting straight up in bed, wide-eyed and trembling. You need to get them out, she whispered, her voice scratchy but urgent. Get who out, Mrs. Abernathy? I asked, checking her vitals. Heart rate elevated, but not dangerously. She pointed to the corner of the room. Those people, they've been standing there for hours, just watching. I glanced where she was pointing. Empty corner, just the faded floral wallpaper and an unused oxygen port. There's no one there, sweetie, I said gently. Sometimes the medications can cause... I'm not hallucinating, she snapped, suddenly lucid. I've been dying long enough to know the difference. They're waiting for me. Three of them. The woman has no eyes. I felt a cold spot between my shoulder blades but kept my professional smile. Let me increase your pain medication. That might help you sleep. She grabbed my wrist with surprising strength. They're not here for me tonight, but they'll be back. I nodded, adjusted her morphine drip, and stayed until she drifted off. Just another night with a palliative patient experiencing end-of-life hallucinations. We see it all the time. The next night was my day off. When I returned for my shift, the charge nurse told me Mrs. Abernathy had been relatively calm. I was relieved. Around midnight, I was at the nurse's station catching up on charts when Mrs. Winters from room 215 pressed her call button.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
It was unusual. Mrs. Winters rarely called for anything. She was 91, had advanced dementia, and mostly kept to herself. Some shifts, she wouldn't say a word. I hurried to her room and found her sitting in her wheelchair by the window, facing the corner. Everything okay, Mrs. Winters? She didn't look at me, just kept staring at the corner. Tell them to leave. I'm not ready yet, my skin prickled. Who do you want to leave? The dark people. They came for Abernathy, but she sent them away. Now they're in here. She pointed to the empty corner of her room. The woman has no eyes. I felt my mouth go dry. Mrs. Winters and Mrs. Abernathy were on opposite sides of the hall. They had never spoken to each other as far as I knew. Mrs. Winters rarely left her room, and her dementia meant she often didn't recognize her own children. There's nobody there, Mrs. Winters, I said, but my voice sounded thin even to my own ears. They're not here for me tonight, she said, echoing Mrs. Abernathy's exact words. But they'll be back. I quickly checked her vitals, made sure she was comfortable, and left. As I closed the door, I could have sworn I saw movement in the corner of my eye. Just a shadow shifting where no shadow should be. At the nurse's station, I mentioned the incident to Diane, the other night nurse. Probably just confusion, she said. or they've been talking. Old folks talk. Mrs. Winters doesn't talk to anyone, I reminded her. And how would she know what Mrs. Abernathy saw? The exact same description, three figures, woman with no eyes? Diane shrugged. Coincidence? Or maybe there's a draft making the curtains move similarly in both rooms. I nodded, not convinced but not wanting to seem unprofessional. Around 3 a.m., I checked on Mrs. Abernathy again. She was awake, staring at the ceiling. They're back, she whispered as soon as I entered. But they're not in here anymore. They found someone else. Before I could respond, a code blue alarm blared from down the hall. Room 220, Mr. Collins, a relatively stable 77-year-old recovering from pneumonia. We rushed to his room, but it was too late. He was already gone, his face frozen in an expression of pure terror, eyes fixed on the corner of the room. As we were calling time of death, Mrs. Winters wheeled herself to the doorway of Mr. Collins' room. I hadn't even noticed her approach. They got him, she said flatly. The eyeless woman touched him. I helped wheel Mrs. Winters back to her room while Diane handled the paperwork for Mr. Collins. As I was tucking her in, she grabbed my wrist just like Mrs. Abernathy had done. Check the security cameras, she whispered. You might see them. I didn't sleep when I got home that morning. Instead, I called a friend who worked in IT at the hospital and asked for a favor. That evening, before my shift, he sent me the security footage from the hallway outside rooms 215 to 220. I watched it three times before I noticed. At 2:57 a.m., three dark figures moved along the hallway wall. The camera angle made it impossible to see their faces clearly, but one was definitely female, and where her eyes should have been, there were just dark smudges. They entered room 220 without opening the door. At 3:01 a.m., the code blue alarm went off. I deleted the email and video. I gave my 2 weeks' notice the next day. I don't know what I saw that night, but I know I never want to see it again. Story 4. I never believed in ghosts until that one night at Greenwood Care Home changed everything for me. I'd been working there for over 6 years as a CNA and later as an LPN. Over time, you grow accustomed to the rhythm of life and death in a personal care home. Patients come and go, and though loss becomes routine, you never really expect them to linger. That night, however, shattered everything I thought I knew about what happens after someone passes. It was a cold, overcast evening in early November in rural Tennessee, the kind of night where a damp chill seeps into your bones, and every creak of the old building sounds like a whispered secret. That day had been particularly heavy. Mrs. Collins, a longtime resident who had battled illness for months, finally gave in. We had done everything we could, and when the moment came, there was nothing left to do but administer CPR on a full code patient who simply wouldn't come back. I remember the desperate energy in the room during those final moments, the frantic flurry of nurses, the beeping of monitors rising in a crescendo, and then, as suddenly as it had begun, silence after the code was called. We'd lost Mr. Reynolds that night. Mr. Reynolds was not like the others. He was a stubborn man, always trying to make his way out, always prodding at the latch on the secure door of the dementia unit. He had a quiet defiance about him, a sense that even in death, he refused to be confined. I don't know if anyone expected him to come back. We'd all moved on, albeit with a sense of sorrow. But that night, as I was cleaning out his room, a routine task meant to prep the space for a new resident, I experienced something I can't rationalize to this day. I was alone in Mr. Reynolds' room. The overhead lights hummed softly, and a faint smell of antiseptic mixed with the lingering odor of sorrow. I methodically packed up his personal effects and tidied the bed. I almost finished when I heard it, the unmistakable sound of a call bell. At first, I thought perhaps someone had pressed it accidentally, or that a coworker had left it on, but this room was empty. The call bell on the nightstand, which had been silent since the code, started chiming again, slow, intermittent rings echoing in the stillness. I froze, my heart skipping a beat. I pressed the button myself, half expectant of it to immediately stutter back to silence, but it continued to ring, each beep more insistent than the last. I called out, "Hello!" into the humming stillness, stepping to the door to check if perhaps someone had accidentally gotten locked behind it. The door was firmly latched, just the way it should be, No one was there. After a few agonizing moments, I switched off the call bell and resumed my work, trying to convince myself it was just a malfunction, a faulty circuit, perhaps. I locked the room and made a note in my log to have someone check the system later. I never did, though I still wonder if that was the start of something I wasn't meant to witness. Later that same night, as the clock neared midnight, our unit was eerily quiet. I had finished my rounds and the rest of the night staff were proving their vigilance in the dimly lit hallways. The corridors of Greenwood Care Home always felt heavy on nights like that, thick with memories and the faint echo of voices past. I just returned from making sure all the call bells were reset when one of the midnight nurses, Carla, came rushing down the hall, her eyes wide and her voice trembling. "Did you see him?" she demanded in a hushed tone as though afraid to shout. "See who?" I replied, heart pounding. "Mr. Reynolds. I swear he was out there, at the end of the hall, just walking, like he was still alive." I paused, disbelief mingling with a creeping dread. "You mean after he died?" Carla nodded vehemently. I couldn't believe it either, but I saw him. He was pacing like he always did, dragging his feet. He didn't look right, just empty and cold. I wanted to dismiss it, to chalk it up to exhaustion and the blurred boundary between grief and reality. But Carla's terrified eyes convinced me that what she had seen was no figment of an overworked mind. I joined her, and together we cautiously crept toward the far end of the hall. The corridor was almost pitch black, the only illumination coming sporadically from emergency exit lights that cast long, uneven shadows along the walls. We both held our breath, half expecting to see Mr. Reynolds standing there in his old stubborn way. And then we heard it. A distant alarm, not the call bell, but the mechanical alarm on the outside door of the dementia unit. A secured door that Mr. Reynolds had notoriously tried to open on countless occasions. The alarm was unmistakable, a loud staccato clanging that echoed down the hall and sent shivers up my spine. I could almost see his silhouette in my mind. The man who'd always fought against confinement, who tried to walk out into the night even if just to prove his stillness. Carla whispered, "That's the door he always tried, the one he'd go for when he wanted to get outside." I felt the hairs on my neck stand up. We both stared at the door as the alarm continued for a few more seconds before abruptly cutting off. There in the darkness, I thought I saw the outline of a tall figure, his back hunched slightly, taking measured steps along the hall. It was impossible, I knew. Mr. Reynolds was gone, and yet that figure moved slowly, deliberately, like a remnant of his defiant life. That single night, with its eerie door slam, its resounding alarm, and that unmistakable sight of a long dead man pacing the hall, remains the most terrifying, inexplicable experience of my career in healthcare. It taught me that sometimes the line between life and death isn't as clear-cut as we'd like to believe, and that in the quiet aftermath of loss, something might just be lingering, watching, and waiting in the shadows. And if you ever find yourself working alone on a cold night, in a building full of memories and quiet goodbyes, remember, the past may never be dead at all. Story 5. I never put much stock into the ghost stories floating around about St. Mercy Hospital. Every town has its folklore, old buildings with unsettling histories, places people swear hold onto something beyond the living. I'd worked in healthcare for years, and the only things I feared were missed medications, short staffing, and the occasional belligerent patient. But one night while cleaning a vacant wing, I found myself in the middle of something I still can't explain. St. Mercy had two hospitals, both ancient, both holding decades of whispered stories about strange happenings. One had stopped functioning as an overnight facility years ago. No one liked working there alone, not because of the silence, but because of what came with the silence. Lights flickering, call bells ringing in empty rooms, doors shifting even though there was no draft. One nurse swore she saw a boy bouncing a ball near pediatrics, but no children had been admitted in months. Others spoke of a woman in a white dress standing at the end of hallways, disappearing before anyone could get close. I ignored most of it. I had a job to do, and ghost stories didn't make beds or wipe down monitors. Until one night, when I was assigned to deep clean the top floor alone. The setup was simple. Clean an empty floor, moving between rooms while allowing the disinfectant to sit for a few minutes before wiping everything down. It was tedious work, but it had a rhythm to it. I kept my headphones in, drowning out the eerie silence with whatever music could keep me alert. The halls were dim, only lit by sporadic ceiling bulbs that cast dull pools of light. I moved from room to room with ease, working quickly to get the job done. No rush, no disturbances. That changed when I entered the last room. I had just finished wiping down the bed, smoothing the sheet carefully. Nothing was there. The fabric was pristine. I stepped out to check another area, letting the disinfectant sit before returning. Maybe 2 minutes passed. I came back, ready to finish up. That's when I saw them. Handprints. Clear as day. Pressed into the freshly wiped bed. Not smeared. Not accidental marks from my own hands. Deliberate. Perfect. My breath caught in my throat. I stood frozen, heart hammering, staring at something that should not be there. The fingers were long, slender, almost delicate. I checked the door. It was still closed. No one had entered. No footprints, no signs of movement, nothing. I stared at those handprints, my mind racing for explanations. Maybe I had done it, but I knew better. I had wiped the bed carefully, meticulously. There had been nothing there when I stepped out. I reached out hesitantly, touching the indentations. The sheet was cold. Not the normal chill of an empty hospital, but something deeper, something that made my skin prickle. I wiped the prints away, fast, heart pounding as I hurried through the last of the cleanup. I didn't linger, didn't look back. I finished the shift with my pulse still racing. That was the last time I cleaned the top floor alone. Story 6, I'm Jenna, a night shift CNA in a long-term care facility just outside Akron, Ohio. I don't scare easy, been wiping shit and catching falls since I was 19. But that one night in room 209, I still can't explain it, and I sure as hell don't talk about it unless someone else brings up weird hospital stuff first. Even now, I get goosebumps thinking about it. It was a Monday, cold, dead quiet, the kind of night where time seems to stretch. We were short-staffed, of course, and I was covering the East Wing alone. That's the side with the memory care patients, mostly late-stage dementia and Parkinson's. Two of my guys in 209, Mr. Heller and Mr. Darrow, both nonverbal, full assist, couldn't move on their own if you paid them. They just stared all night, sometimes moaned. Their call lights were wrapped on their rails, just like always, but neither one of them had pressed it in months. So when the light above 209 flicked on around 2:17 a.m., I just stared at the board for a second, like maybe I was seeing it wrong. Was that a glitch? I said out loud, mostly to myself. Sometimes the wiring acts up when it rains. But it was dry that night. I grabbed a pair of gloves and headed down. As soon as I walked in, it was that kind of cold where your breath feels sharp. Not chilly, cold. And I swear to God, both of them were wide awake, just staring straight ahead, not at me, not at each other. Just blank but locked in, like they were listening. I pressed the call light to reset it, checked their vitals real quick. Normal. Turned off the main light and backed out. I didn't like the way they looked at nothing like that. It gave me this crawling feeling in my spine. I made it maybe two rooms down when the light came back on. I stopped in the hall. No one else had passed me. No one else was near 209, so I turned around, a little less calm now. Walked fast but quiet, opened the door, and my stomach just dropped. Both call lights, their whole cords, were unplugged from the wall and thrown under the beds. Not just slipped out, tossed, far enough that I had to kneel and reach deep to fish one of them out. Mr. Heller blinked at me. His fingers twitched like they sometimes did, but there was no way in hell he'd gotten out of bed. I've helped him with everything from bedpans to bathing. His arms can barely lift a spoon. All right, which one of you's messing with me? I half-joked, even though I already knew the answer. Neither of them said a word, obviously. They just stared. I plugged the cords back in, looped them tighter this time, and checked the wall sockets. Nothing loose. No signs of tampering. I stood up and whispered, more to the room than them, "Don't do that again." Then I left. I didn't make it to the end of the hallway before I heard it. click. That distinct mechanical click of a nurse call being triggered. I turn slowly. Light above 209 dash on. I don't know how to explain what happened next without sounding completely insane, but I'll tell you what I saw, exactly how it happened. I walked back, forcing myself not to run. When I opened the door, this time without knocking, I saw both beds were untouched, but the call lights were wrapped back around the rails. Plugged in, perfectly neat, exactly how I'd left them the first time, and both men were still awake, still staring, but not at nothing. They were looking at the ceiling, so I looked up too. There was something, someone, pressed up against the tiles. Not like they were crawling or hiding, but like they'd been flattened into it. Thin black limbs stretched from corner to corner, torso sunken like dried paper, face just a pale oval, featureless except for a mouth that was open way too wide. I froze, couldn't move, couldn't breathe. That thing didn't move either. It just watched. I don't know if it had eyes, but I knew it was watching me. Mr. Heller suddenly whimpered, and the lights in the room, all of them, flickered hard, then went out. The hallway stayed lit, so I backed out into it, shaking. I pressed the emergency button on my pager and called for another nurse. All I said was, "Something's wrong in 209. When Liz came, I didn't tell her what I saw. I couldn't. We walked in together, lights back on now. Ceiling was empty. The guys were asleep, dead asleep, like nothing happened. Nothing was out of place. She looked at me and said, "Jenna, they're fine." I nodded, but I didn't go near that room again for the rest of the night. The next day, both patients were unresponsive. Not dead, but different, like the light went out in them. They were already gone in the dementia sense. But this was something else. I'd seen them smile before, at music or soft voices. But after that night, there was nothing. No eye movement, no vocal sounds, no tension in their bodies at all. They died within 24 hours of each other, 3 days later. And I'll tell you one more thing, not because I think it proves anything, but because it still messes with me. When I went to help the funeral home with Mr. Heller's transfer, I saw his call light cord lying on his bed, still looped perfectly around the rail. Unplugged. Story 7. I was stationed at Forward Operating Base Speaker in Iraq back in 2008. That place had its own kind of silence. Not the peaceful kind. More like a heavy, waiting silence. I was part of a security detail rotating night shifts at the combat hospital, the CHS, which usually meant a lot of boredom and stale coffee. But that night was different. It was some time after 200. The air was thick, the kind of dry heat that makes your skin itch even in the dark. The whole base had been quiet for days. No shelling, no trauma cases, nothing. Most of the medical staff were racked out, and the CHS was on full standby. I was patrolling solo on the East Wing, where they treated local civilians when things got bad, IEDs, burns, kids who got caught in the crossfire. It wasn't in use that week, so it was supposed to be locked down and dark. I rounded a corner and saw one of the patient rooms glowing like a lantern. I stopped. Room 3. We didn't leave those lights on. That entire wing had been shut since Monday. I walked up, toggled the switch down, lights clicked off, and I stood there for a second just listening. Nothing. No hum, no movement. Just that dead silence again. Started walking off when I caught the light flick on behind me, bright as hell in that darkness. My boots stopped mid-step. I spun around, same room, light back on. I'm not the superstitious type, but I didn't like that one bit. I unslung my M4, safety off, kept it at low ready. My boots barely made a sound as I crept back to that room. I cleared the doorway like I was breaching, sweeping corners, checking under the gurney, behind the curtain. Empty. Just a single cot, a crash cart, and an unplugged heart monitor blinking with static for no reason. I flicked the switch off again and stared at it like I was daring it to move. Waited a solid minute. Nothing. Then I pressed my comm to call it in, but I just got static. I checked the signal. Battery. Fine. Still dead. That made my skin crawl. I don't like coincidences like that. Started walking fast toward the CQ desk, past the operating bays, when that same room behind me lit up again. It was like the light punched through the darkness. I turned so fast my gear clacked against the wall. I went back, slower this time, less like a soldier, more like someone approaching an animal they didn't want to spook. When I turned into the doorway, the air felt wrong. Colder, heavier, no movement, same layout. Except this time, the light switch was up. I swear to God, I had pushed it down. Twice. I should have left it at that. I should have just walked away. But I stepped inside. My boots echoed too loud for such a small room. That static from the monitor started again. No reason. It wasn't even connected to a patient. That's when I felt it. You ever walk into a room and just know you're not alone? Like someone standing right next to you, just barely out of sight? It was like that. The air pressed against me. I kept staring at the cot, like something should be lying there. Then I said it. I don't even know why. If you're scared of the dark, I said, I'll leave the light on for you. I don't know what made me say that. Maybe the tension broke me a little. Maybe deep down I thought something was listening. But as soon as I said it, the heart monitor, it beeped once. Just a single sharp tone. Not static, not malfunctioning. A heartbeat. One. Then silence. I backed out of there fast, kept my eyes on the gurney until I cleared the doorway. I left the light on. I didn't touch that switch again. When I got back to the CQ desk, I didn't mention any of it. Just told them one of the surgeons said to keep room 3's light on in case of emergency. Wrote it down. Logged it. Nobody questioned it. But I checked every night after that. The light was always on. Even after other rooms were cycled and patients came and went, room 3 stayed lit. I never went back inside that room, but I made sure the light never got turned off again. I don't care what it was. I don't want to understand it. I just remember that feeling, the weight in the air, like something was right beside me, and that single echoing beep. I didn't imagine it. I know I didn't. Story 8. I'm Mark, a registered nurse from New Mexico. I did most of my early shifts at a mid-sized Catholic hospital near the edge of town. Quiet place, low patient volume, old building. It was the kind of hospital where the walls echoed even when nobody was talking, like the silence itself had weight. This happened in 2017 on a slow Thursday night. I was floating between med-surg and geriatrics, helping wherever they needed an extra pair of hands. Around 2:30 in the morning, I was stationed on the third floor. That ward was mostly empty, just 3 patients total, all post-op. One was an old woman, Mrs. Castillo, in room 313. She'd been brought in earlier that day after a fall at her care home. Nothing serious, just observation and pain meds. I checked on her around midnight. She was coherent, a little disoriented, but nothing unusual. Her vitals were good, and she was asleep when I left. No weirdness, no fuss. But then her granddaughter, who was spending the night in the recliner by the window, came flying down the hall, barefoot and pale as paper. "Something's wrong with my grandma," she gasped. "Her bed's... it's shaking. She's screaming. I don't know what's happening. Please!" I grabbed another nurse, Angela, and we ran to 313. I honestly expected a seizure, maybe a med reaction. But when we got there, I stopped cold at the door. Mrs. Castillo was clutching the bed rails like she was bracing for an earthquake. The entire hospital bed was violently shaking, metal rattling, wheels scraping slightly against the floor. She was sobbing, yelling, "Déjeunez en paz," over and over. "Leave me alone." Angela muttered, "What the hell?" I stepped in first. I wanted to believe the shaking was just her thrashing around in pain, but I swear to God, she wasn't moving. Her legs were under the blanket, arms stiff on the rails. She was locked in place, not thrashing, and she weighed maybe 90 pounds, tops. There's no way she had the strength to rock a full hospital bed like that. I reached for the bed controls, trying to stabilize it, and the second my hand touched the frame, it stopped. Just stopped. Not gradually, instantly. No aftershocks, no wobble, just total stillness. Angela checked the IV. Meds, everything. Vitals were normal. No fever. No signs of distress beyond sheer terror. We calmed Mrs. Castillo down, took a full neuro check, nothing. But the granddaughter wouldn't go back in the room. She just kept saying, it was the bed. It wasn't her. It was the bed. I didn't say anything, but I agreed with her. That bed had moved itself. There's no other explanation that fits. After we settled things, Angela pulled me aside and asked if I'd ever worked the third floor before. Not really, I told her. She nodded like she expected that. There's something off about room 313. The older nurses say don't use that bed by the window unless you have to. I thought it was just superstition. Why? She hesitated, like she didn't want to say it out loud. People complain about it. Not the bed exactly. The window, maybe. Patients say they hear laughing. Kids' voices. Like, right next to them. And they dream of hands grabbing them. But it's always just that bed. Always. I wanted to brush it off. Say it was just sleep meds or post-op delirium. But the next morning, before my shift ended, I passed by 313 to check again. Mrs. Castillo was awake, calm, watching the window. She looked up at me and whispered, "The children were under the bed. I saw their fingers." My stomach turned. "What children?" "They said they were cold. They asked if they could climb in." I didn't answer. I couldn't. I filed my report, kept it professional, but I told the charge nurse to move Mrs. Castillo to a different room for the rest of her stay. No explanation, just a request. She didn't argue. That bed by the window hasn't been used since. Maintenance swears it's fine. No mechanical issues, no defects. Still, it just sits there, empty, perfectly made up. The sheets always tucked too tight, like no one ever touched them. I haven't stepped foot in room 313 since that night, and I never will. Story 9. I used to work nights in the sub-basement of a mid-sized hospital just outside of Flagstaff, Arizona. I'm an OR nurse now, but back then, I worked in central supply. It was mostly restocking, organizing carts, doing inventory, boring stuff, quiet too. Just me and one other person scheduled overnight, usually in separate parts of the building. The place already had a weird energy, being underground and all. No windows, no noise except the hum of lights and the occasional knock of the pipes. But after a few weeks, you stop noticing. I never believed the stories about weird things happening in hospitals. People blame ghosts for bad wiring and sleep deprivation. I'm practical, or at least I used to be. This happened on a Monday night in November. I remember because my shift started right after the long weekend. My coworker James was upstairs doing a supply run to pediatrics. I had the basement to myself. It was around 2 a.m. when I heard it, a single low whistle from the hallway that leads to the service elevator. Not a tune, just one drawn-out note, like someone trying to get your attention without being seen. Now here's the thing. I whistle. I do it constantly when I'm sorting shelves or counting gloves. Didn't even realize it until James mentioned it a couple weeks in. So hearing a whistle didn't immediately scare me. I figured maybe I'd done it absentmindedly. But then it came again. Same pitch, same length, exactly the same. I stood up from the cart I was stocking, leaned into the hallway, and called out, "James?" Nothing. I walked to the end of the hallway. No one there. The elevator wasn't even on the floor. Its light was off. The air felt heavy, like after a thunderstorm. And the whole corridor smelled faintly like antiseptic and wet metal. I told myself it was in my head and went back to the break room. 15 minutes later, I'm sitting on the break room couch eating string cheese and scrolling on my phone when I hear a loud bang, like metal slamming into concrete. I jump up and open the door, and there it is, a hospital bed rolling down the hallway. Not fast, but steady. The wheels squeaked, and it kept bumping side to side like someone had pushed it and let go. I immediately thought, James is screwing with me. He's always messing around, trying to get me to believe the creepy stories the older techs tell. I radioed him. "James, you down here?" His voice came through casual as ever. "Nope, still on 7. Cafeteria now. Why?" I didn't answer, just stared at the bed until it hit the wall and stopped. I walked past it toward the laundry room, thinking maybe he ran and ducked in there. As soon as I passed the door, the washers kicked on. All of them, one after another. I froze. They weren't on a timer. We only used the laundry room for emergency linens at night, and none of them were full. I opened the door. Empty room. No lights flickering. No sound but the washer spinning and water sloshing. "James," I said louder now, "cut it out." No answer. I stepped inside, and just as my foot crossed the threshold, everything stopped. Machine silent, light steady. I backed out. My palms were sweating. Something felt off, like the floor was vibrating under my shoes, but it wasn't. I turned and speedwalked to the elevator, hit the button. It lit up red. I stood there, heart pounding. Then behind me, the whistle came again. I didn't turn around. It was right behind me. I could feel it. I pressed the elevator button again, harder. The hallway behind me stayed silent. No footsteps. Just that awful feeling that something was watching. Then I heard it. Soft crashes from the end of the hallway, one after the other. I turned my head and saw boxes falling off the metal shelves. Slowly, like someone was pulling them down one by one. Gloves, four tubes, packets of gauze. It was deliberate. Not like they fell, like they were being knocked off, one after another, in a straight line toward me. The elevator dinged. I stepped inside and hit the close door button. Just as the doors started to shut, I felt something brush my left arm. Not air, not static. A fingertip. I slapped the emergency close button. The doors sealed. I didn't even breathe until I reached the second floor. I found James eating chips in the cafeteria. I must have looked pale because he dropped the bag and said, "Dude, what happened?" I told him everything. He didn't laugh, just stared at me, then said, "You know what's fucked up?" "What?" "I've been whistling all night too. Didn't even think about it." "Same tone you do." I didn't finish my shift. I left the badge on the counter and drove home in silence. Never worked down there again. Transferred to the OR a few weeks later. Story 10, I used to work night shift security at a hospital in Chicago, one of the oldest in the city. Been there for 5 years before I finally quit. And I'll be honest, I saw some messed up stuff during those overnight rounds. But nothing, and I mean nothing, messed me up like what I saw in Building 6. Everyone on staff just called it the old psych, even though it had been converted into admin offices long before I started. The building dates back to the late 1800s, back when mental health care was basically torture with a medical excuse. Restraint chairs, ice baths, even isolation chambers are rumored to have been used down in the basement. The place has history, let's just put it that way. Some guards refused to do rounds there altogether. I wasn't superstitious, so I took them, without blinking, until the night that changed that. It was just past 2 a.m., dead quiet. I was doing solo rounds, standard sweep. The offices were empty at night. Most of the pencil pushers were out the door by 5 p.m. sharp. One of the rules was that we had to check each floor and make sure all the office doors were locked. Patient information gets left behind sometimes, and that's a big liability. So I'm walking the third floor. Narrow hallway, old tiles, flickering fluorescence overhead. It always had this damp smell, even in the middle of summer. I was moving steady, checking both sides of the hall as I went. Door after door, all locked, no problems. At the end of the hallway, there's a pair of double doors. You go through them to reach one last office, kind of tucked into this dead-end alcove. I checked it. Door locked, room empty. Everything as it should be. I turned around and walked back through the double doors and just stopped cold. Every single office door was open, not just cracked, set open, perfectly like someone had lined them up at the exact angle where gravity wouldn't pull them shut. I'm telling you, there were 20 doors on that hallway, and all of them were wide open. And at the very end of the hallway, maybe 15 feet from the staircase, was a wheelchair, facing the stairs, just sitting there. That wheelchair was not there 30 seconds ago. I would have seen it. I did see the hallway when I walked into the dead-end office. It was clear. I'm not crazy. I stood there for a solid minute, barely breathing, trying to convince myself I was being stupid, that maybe I missed the doors. Maybe the cleaning crew came through and forgot to close them. But there was no cleaning crew that night. I checked the schedule earlier in the shift. No one was assigned to that floor. I pulled out my flashlight and started backing up. Slow, like whatever did that was still watching me. I swear I could feel it. Like the air had weight. Like I'd walked into someone's bedroom uninvited. And then I heard it. Creak. One of the doors, maybe 5 feet from me, moved. Not fully, just an inch. But it was enough. I turned and ran. Didn't even pretend to keep it cool. I ran all the way down the stairs, radioed in that I was having equipment issues, and handed off my shift to the next guy 30 minutes early. Next day, my supervisor asked why I logged out early. I told him straight up, "I'm not doing Building 6 anymore." He just nodded. Didn't even question it. Didn't write me up. That's when I knew. It wasn't just me. Something's wrong with that floor. I don't know what happened in that building 100 years ago, but whatever it was, it didn't stay buried. And no, I never went back. Not even once. Thanks for watching. Don't leave before leaving a like to this video. Also hit the subscribe button to support my work. And as always, have a horrific nightmare, my dear.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
Look at you go, knocking stuff out, letting nothing get in the way. Whatever life throws at you, you throw it back at 97 miles an hour. And if the chips are down, you make more guacamole. Yes, you got what it takes. Because there's no stopping you with you on your side. Everwise believes in the power of you, cheering as you take on the world. Everwise Credit Union. Confidence changes everything. Now go get 'em.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.